Welcome to this eDiabetes Review Podcast. I'm Bob Busker, Managing Editor of the program. We're here with Dr. Anders Carlson. He's Medical Director at the International Diabetes Center in Minneapolis and Assistant Professor at the University of Minnesota Medical School. eDiabetes Review is jointly presented by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing. This program is supported by educational grants from Merck & Company, Incorporated, Novo Nordisk, and Sanofi. Learning objectives for this audio program include identify circumstances where patients with type 2 diabetes may benefit from continuous glucose monitoring, or CGM. Describe how to interpret CGM data reports using AGP, that's ambulatory glucose profiles, and differentiate between flash CGM and real-time CGM. Dr. Carlson has indicated that he has served as a principal investigator for Medtronic Incorporated and Novo Nordisk. He has served as a sub-investigator for Johnson & Johnson and received consulting fees from Merck and Sanofi. And he's indicated that there will be no references to the unlabeled or unapproved uses of any drugs or products. Dr. Carlson, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So, continuous glucose monitoring. We know it's proven its value in type 1 diabetes, and the evidence you presented in your newsletter issue indicates it can be similarly beneficial for patients with type 2. To look at CGM and type 2 diabetes from a clinical perspective, let me ask you to start us out, if you would please, with a patient scenario.
So here is a 48-year-old female with type 2 diabetes for 7 years coming to your clinic for follow-up. She really only checks fingerstick blood glucose levels once or maybe twice a day, generally fasting in the morning, but sometimes later in the evening. And you are able to download that glucose meter and see an average of 188 milligrams per deciliter over the last 2 weeks. Her hemoglobin A1Cs generally range in the 8 to 9% range, despite her being on maximum doses of metformin, glipizide, and once daily basal insulin glargine, which has been recently titrated up to 38 units at bedtime. Now, she has some symptomatic hypoglycemia. It's rare, maybe one or two episodes a month, and she usually can predict it because it happens after she's very active. She's met with diabetes education and a dietitian in the past, but she tells you that she knows what she should do and just struggles to do it on her own. Her BMI is 32, and she's motivated to start a weight loss program in the near future.
Treatment options for a patient like this, what would you recommend?
Well, our options are still the same in the sense that we stress education, nutrition counseling, and lifestyle modification as really the pillars of diabetes management. In this case, the only data we have to go off of are her A1C, blood glucose log, and occasional symptoms of hypoglycemia. That can be kind of frustrating for both the patient and the clinician since there's not much data there to go off of, and that can translate into clinical inertia if you're concerned about increasing a medication dose that might result in a hypoglycemia, for instance. So in this case, rather than adjusting her medication, you could get a retrospective CGM data collection to help decide on the next therapy and also to demonstrate to her what her glucoses are doing the rest of the day when she's not checking them.
Retrospective CGM. Well, what is that exactly?
Retrospective, or what we sometimes call professional CGM, is a CGM that's owned by the clinic and then worn by the patient for just a few days or up to 2 weeks. And in the Hawk et al. Study that is reviewed in the newsletter, they used one of these devices to gather retrospective glucose data on their subjects. What it means to be retrospective is that patients are blinded to the data, so they don't see their blood glucose in real time. The machine itself is recording all of that, and the clinic is able to download it at a later time. During that period, though, that the patient is wearing the device, they keep a detailed log of their medication doses, their diets, their activity, and so on, so that when we sit down to look at the overall glucose pattern, we can look for places that may have affected that and then use that to guide our therapy. And what we get from these are very visual. So the data that comes off of that retrospective CGM is very objective. It really is the continuous glucose readings for that patient's last several days to 2 weeks. And that can really direct our next steps. So for instance, we often use CGM patterns to titrate insulin doses or adjust other diabetes medications. If someone is on basal insulin and they're having a lot of fasting hypoglycemia, we can adjust that dose downward. Or if they're having postprandial hyperglycemia, that might be a place where we titrate up on prandial insulin. For example, the patient in the case has nocturnal hypoglycemia many nights, more than she's reporting and more than she's having symptoms of, but she's also spiking to nearly 200 milligrams per deciliter after most lunch and dinner meals. And so we can use that to help guide our therapy.
Using CGM data to change your management approach. Step us through that process, if you would please, doctor.
Once you have the data off of the device and download it into a report, you can turn it around to the patient and ask, what pattern do you see here? What makes sense on these readings of your blood glucose levels for the last several days or 2 weeks? You know, does it agree with what you think or not, and why? And so it's a great visual tool. It also empowers patients to see their own data and to use it, and then also to see how their diet and activity and lifestyle can affect their glucose levels. So in this case, with her having frequent nocturnal hypoglycemia, if you didn't have the CGM data and went purely by A1C and increased her basal insulin, that could have been potentially harmful and put her at risk for more nocturnal hypoglycemia. In her case, with the elevated postprandial glucose levels, something like a GLP-1 receptor agonist or an SGLT2 inhibitor might be a better therapeutic choice to target that postprandial glucose control. And of course, it's quite personalized because we know that one of her concerns is losing weight, and certainly using a medication that can promote weight loss and not contribute to weight gain would be beneficial.
Analyzing CGM data and sharing those findings with the patient, that can add a whole new dimension to caring for type 2 patients. Question though, how often can you perform a CGM analysis on any particular patient?
The studies I reviewed in the newsletter issue showed the optimal interval for CGM analyses has not been established in type 2 diabetes. For instance, in the Kesavetov et al. Study, it was a one-time-only reading, whereas in the Beck et al. Study, it was a continuous tracing. However, the benefits of CGM use in type 2 diabetes has been demonstrated in those both on and not on intensive insulin therapy. Most insurance plans will not reimburse CGM if it's done more frequently than once a month, so it's important that you check with that patient's insurance plan to see, you know, how often you can perform some of these CGM analyses. One of the benefits to it, however, is that the interpretation and the feedback given to the patient doesn't necessarily need to be face-to-face. And so sometimes these are great tools to use in between clinic visits. For instance, if you're seeing the patients every 3 to 4 months, having them do a retrospective CGM once a month can kind of help you not lose the momentum you've had in adjusting and titrating your therapy.
What do the guidelines say about who might benefit the most from CGM?
The guidelines that exist, especially as mentioned in the Dan et al. Study reviewed in the newsletter, suggest that CGM could be beneficial for those on intensive insulin therapy or those at high risk for hypoglycemia. So in those instances, I would probably perform it more frequently. And if the patient found that this was helpful and really reacted to their data, we can set them up with a personal CGM device, which will give them the glucose data in real time, and they own the device and wear it continuously.
Which CGM devices are available for patients with type 2?
The real-time CGMs available in the U.S. are the Dexcom, Medtronic, and Eversense, and they give blood glucose readings about every 5 minutes and then send them to the patient where they can receive it either on a smartphone or on some other type of receiver. Those devices then can alert the patient to high blood glucose or low blood glucose, or patients can set different preferences within it. So it can be really helpful for them to have as a personal device. The choice to use real-time CGM versus professional CGM really comes down to patient preference and clinician preference and really what you hope to achieve with the CGM.
Thank you for that case and discussion, doctor. And we'll return with Dr. Anders Carlson in just a moment. This is Bob Busker, Managing Editor of eDiabetes Review. eDiabetes Review is a combination newsletter and podcast program delivered via email to subscribers. Newsletters are published every other month. Each issue reviews the current literature in areas of importance to clinicians treating patients with type 2 diabetes. In the month following each newsletter, a case-based podcast discussion, like the one you're listening to now, is available to help translate that new clinical information into practice. These podcasts are also available as downloadable transcripts. Subscription to eDiabetes Review is provided without charge or prerequisite. Continuing education credit for each newsletter and each podcast is provided by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing. For more information on this educational activity, to subscribe and receive eDiabetes Review without charge, and to access back issues, please go to our website, www.ediabetesreview.org. Thank you. Welcome back to this eDiabetes Review podcast. We've been talking with Dr. Andres Carlson from the International Diabetes Center in Minneapolis about CGM, continuous glucose monitoring, in patients with type 2 diabetes. So to continue from a clinical perspective, doctor, if you would please bring us another patient scenario.
This is a 36-year-old male recently diagnosed with type 2 diabetes based on a screening A1C of 7.9 and a fasting glucose of 140 milligrams per deciliter. He's got a strong family history of diabetes and is overweight with hypertension and dyslipidemia. He's met with a diabetes educator and started on metformin with lifestyle changes. However, he's extremely motivated to lose weight and try to minimize number of medications he takes.
How can CGM benefit a patient like this?
CGM can be very useful for pattern recognition. And in his case, he wants to focus on diet and lifestyle, which of course are fundamental to managing diabetes. We opted to do a real-time CGM tracing, which would not be blinded to him, so that he could see the blood glucose readings in real time, but also maintain a log of his diet and exercise and so on, so that we could focus on particular patterns when we met back after he completed the study. For instance, there was one day where he exercised in the mid-afternoon and then had a smaller dinner than usual, and by bedtime, his glucose was one of the lowest readings he had had in a while. On another instance, there was a weekend night where he indulged in a big meal with a dessert and had a really big spike in glucose that lasted well into the overnight. Now, knowing those two things would help him in the future make different or better decisions about his diet and activity and correspond both of those things to how they affect his glucose and help him manage his diabetes in a way that he wouldn't necessarily be able to with fingerstick blood glucose monitoring.
There's a lot of data being produced by CGM.
You're absolutely right. There is a lot of data generated by these devices. Instead of one or two finger stick readings a day, you're getting possibly hundreds of them in a day. And most CGMs are reporting into something called an ambulatory glucose profile, or an AGP. AGPs are a way to display glucose data in a very visual form.
Visual? How so?
Most of the time, you will see an AGP with some basic glucose statistics at the top with a description of the time in different glucose ranges. In the middle, there will be a plot with the time of day on the x-axis and the glucose level for that time period on the y-axis. And on the bottom, you'll have the daily CGM tracing so you can see individual days. Now, you can see an example of this at agpreport.org, where we have developed some tools about visualizing and utilizing AGPs in clinical practice. They've been designed to be understandable and easy to interpret for both clinicians and for patients. And so we often use these as a very straightforward visual description of their glucose patterns to show patients right there in the clinic.
So analyzing an AGP in practice, what are the key things you look for?
I think when you look at an AGP, it's important to note how many days of data they have and whether the data is adequate, so you know that you're making a sound decision based on enough actual data. And then from there, I ask patients to write on the report when they eat, when they exercise, and so on, so that you can start to see the pattern emerge of their typical week or day. And then I move on to looking at time and ranges. And particularly important is the time spent in a hypoglycemia glucose range. Many of our therapies have hypoglycemia as a risk, and certainly that is one of our biggest goals in diabetes management, is to minimize hypoglycemia. So that's where I usually start. And then from there, we look at hyperglycemia as well as variability. Using those factors, you can hone in on different parts of the day that maybe need a little bit extra attention or where an adjustment in therapy might be indicated. And once you put those together, I like to just send the whole report home with patients with our markings on it and so on, so that they have an actual visualization of their AGP and their glucose profile. And they can use that at home for comparison to past ones, or we can pull them up in the electronic medical record when they come in for their next visit.
Well, how difficult is it to learn how to read an AGP?
You can think of it like an EKG for diabetes. They've been designed to be pretty intuitive, in fact, even for patients to utilize on their own. So I think most clinicians will find that they're fairly easy to understand right off the bat. There are a few metrics in the statistics part that may not be immediately obvious to the clinicians, but with time, I think more and more people will find those useful. Our hope is that it becomes standardized and people can talk about it interchangeably. We do have a description on the website agpreport.org that describes in some detail how to interpret these AGPs, but it does take some practice. And I would encourage clinicians to talk to their diabetes educators or their local endocrinologists about perhaps reviewing with them how to read and interpret these AGPs.
Thank you for that explanation, Doctor. Now, we've got time for one more patient scenario, so if you would, please.
This is a 62-year-old male with long-standing type 2 diabetes going back nearly 20 years. He has complications including mild retinopathy and gradually worsening neuropathy. His A1C is usually in the 8.5 to 10% range, and he's very reluctant to take a basal insulin along with a metformin, sulfonylurea, and weekly GLP-1 he takes. He does have hypoglycemia, but it's quite rare, and he says he's always able to self-treat it. He works with his hands, and as a mechanic, he absolutely refuses to do fingerstick blood glucose readings, so we've been a little bit limited in titrating his medications because of lack of glucose data. He does not like being reminded of diabetes and thinks it's already a heavy burden on him and really doesn't want to do anything more than the daily and weekly shots he is doing.
What would you recommend doing to get this patient under better control?
I think typically the next step would be to add mealtime insulin, since he's already on 3 non-insulin therapies and not at A1C goal, but that's not really factoring in his unique situation. Moreover, since he's not checking blood glucose levels and he's already at high risk of hypoglycemia, I would not want to give him more insulin without having more data, as that could be quite dangerous. I think many of us would try to push him for more diabetes education, which I think is always a good idea, and maybe try to push him to check a few fingerstick blood glucose levels a few times a day so we can try to see some semblance of a pattern. However, that might be difficult since that hasn't worked for him in the past. Now, of course, you could add another medication, such as an SGLT2 inhibitor or switching him to a different insulin delivery device, such as a patch pump. But in this case, you're doing those things somewhat blindly because we just don't have enough data.
As you've been pointing out throughout our discussion, making changes when you don't have enough data can be very dangerous. So tell us how CGM could be helpful here.
In this case, something like a flash CGM. Currently in the U.S., we have the Freestyle Libre as the only flash CGM, and that was reviewed in the newsletter like in the Hock et al. Study. And these devices are factory calibrated, so they do not require routine fingerstick blood glucose checks, and they can be worn for 10 days, so there's pretty minimal work to keep this device up and running. It's worn on the back of the arm, which is rather discreet, and it's simply used by flashing a reader device over the sensor, and that will give the patient their current blood glucose level. In this case, the patient isn't checking any fingerstick blood glucose levels, but in the Hack et al. Study, it was noted that patients started to scan about 7 times per day. So going from 0 to 7 blood glucose readings in a day will really help us guide therapy.
All right, 7 scans a day. What does he do with those results?
This is where education is key. He needs to learn both how to use the data to prevent problems, but also how to use it to solve them. For instance, if he flashes the glucose monitor before a meal, and let's say he has a blood glucose that's high, he may want to reduce the amount of carb in his meal or the portion size, or perhaps take a walk or something after that meal. But moreover, he can then use that information to think about how he got high in the first place and maybe adjust the meal before or snacking earlier in the day to avoid those highs in the future. On the other hand, let's say he's starting to have some low blood glucose levels at work and he starts feeling a little shaky. In the past, he would typically eat an entire bag of candy or a full candy bar to bring his glucose up, and he wouldn't really know how high he was spiking after that because he wasn't able to check. But now if he had a CGM on, he may want to just have a little bit amount of carbohydrate, like 10 to 15 grams, wait a little while, and then re-scan his glucose, and then only treat with further carbohydrate if he's still low. Again, here, this requires quite a bit of education, but now we have some data to go by, and we're not just blindly guessing. And so with more education, I think we can help him with the regimen that he's currently on.
Well, thank you for today's cases and discussion, Dr. Carlson. Let's wrap things up now by revisiting our learning objectives. So to begin, circumstances where patients with type 2 diabetes can benefit from CGM.
As a clinician, I'm always looking for new and better tools to help my patients live better with their diabetes. And I think newer technologies like CGM are going to revolutionize how we talk to patients about glucose patterns and how we start or stop medication therapies. I think it's helpful for unmasking patterns, especially hypoglycemia in those on high-risk therapies for that. And I also think we're going to see patients starting to use the flash CGM as a method to track their glucose, perhaps instead of fingerstick blood glucose levels. Moreover, I think we might see patients with type 2 diabetes start to use real-time CGM because they want to see their data in the real time and adjust medication and lifestyle and diet and so on in response to those actual real-time blood glucose levels.
And our second learning objective, interpreting CGM data using the ambulatory glucose profile, or AGP.
The AGP gives very practical information about a patient's glucose pattern. It provides the when, the why, and the how much the glucose changes during the day. So being so easy to visualize, the patterns of hypoglycemia and hyperglycemia readily emerge, and they're present so that both the clinician and the patient can see them and react to those findings. I think as it becomes more standardized across different devices and platforms, it'll become even more easy for people to understand and react to, almost like an EKG for diabetes. And as an aside, clinicians can bill for interpretation of continuous glucose monitoring data, which is something that we haven't been able to do in the past with fingerstick blood glucose checks.
And finally, differentiating between real-time CGM and flash CGM.
Well, both real-time and flash CGM can be used either professionally in the sense that the clinic owns the device or personally where the patient owns the device. Flash monitoring is calibrated in the factory and so does not require fingerstick blood glucose checks, which may be preferable to some patients. The flash system does not have any alarms for hypoglycemia or hyperglycemia. So the real-time monitors may be preferred for patients who want or would really benefit from alarms. The real-time systems also have the ability to connect with smartphones and in some cases have the ability for other individuals like family or friends to visualize that patient's CGM data. So really it's up to the patient and their preferences as well as the clinician to have a conversation about the pros and cons of each of them and which one would be best for that individual.
From the University of Minnesota Medical School and the International Diabetes Center in Minneapolis, Dr. Anders Carlson, thank you for participating in this eDiabetes Review podcast.
Well, thank you, and it's been my pleasure to be here with you today.
To receive CME credit for this activity, please take the post-test at www.ediabetesreview.org. This podcast is presented in conjunction with the eDiabetes Review newsletter, a peer-reviewed literature review certified for CME CE credit, emailed monthly to clinicians treating patients with type 2 diabetes. This activity has been planned and implemented in accordance with the accreditation requirements and policies of the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME, through the joint providership of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing. The Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine is accredited by the ACCME to provide continuing education for physicians. The Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine designates this enduring material for a maximum of 0.5 AMA PRA Category 1 credit. Physicians should claim only the credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in this activity. The Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing is accredited as a provider of continuing nursing education by the American Nurses Credentialing Center's Commission on Accreditation. For nurses, this 0.5 contact hour educational activity is provided by the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing. Each podcast carries a maximum of 0.5 contact hour. This educational resource is provided without charge, but registration is required. To register to receive eDiabetes via email, please go to our website, www.ediabetesreview.org. The opinions and recommendations expressed by faculty and other experts whose input is included in this program are their own. This enduring material is produced for educational purposes only. Use of the names of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing implies review of educational format, design, and approach. Please review the complete prescribing information for specific drugs, combinations of drugs, or use of medical equipment, including indication, contraindications, warnings, and adverse effects before administering therapy to patients. eDiabetes Review is supported by educational grants from Merck & Company, Incorporated, Novo Nordisk, and Sanofi. This program is copyright with all rights reserved by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine.